Chapter 29. Something's rotten in Denmark. Summer ignored her brother's words and held a small bowl of fish stew up to her nose. After uninterrupted confinement for most of the day, the heavy door of their cabin had burst open and a galley cook wearing a white apron entered with a tray containing the stew, some rice, and a pot of tea. An armed guard watched menacingly from the hallway as the food was set down, and the nervous cook quickly left without saying a word. Summer was famished and eagerly surveyed the food as the door was bolted back shut from the outside. Taking a deep whiff of the fish stew, she wrinkled her nose. "I think there's a few things rotten around here as well," she said. Moving on to the rice, she drove a pair of chopsticks into the bowl and began munching on the steamed grains. At last, bringing relief to her hunger pangs, she turned her attention back to Dirk, who sat gazing out the porthole window. "Aside from our crummy lower berth cabin, what's bugging you now?" she asked. "Don't quote me on this, but I don't think we're headed to Japan." "How can you tell?" Summer asked, scooping a mound of rice into her mouth. "I've been observing the sun and the shadows cast off the ship. We should be heading north-northeast if we were traveling to Japan, but it appears to me that our course heading is more to the northwest." "That's a fine line to distinguish with the naked eye." "Agreed. But I just call them as I see them. If we pull into Nagasaki, then just send me back to Celestial Navigation School." "That would mean we're heading towards the Yellow Sea," she replied, picturing an imaginary map of the region in her head. "Do you think we're sailing to China?" "Could be. There's certainly no love lost between China and Japan. Perhaps the Japanese Red Army has a base of operations in China. That might explain the lack of success the authorities have had in tracking down any suspects in Japan." "Possibly. But they'd have to be operating with state knowledge or sponsorship, and I would hope they'd think twice before sinking an American research vessel." "True. Then again, there is another possibility." Summer nodded, waiting for Dirk to continue. "The two Japanese hoods who shot up my Chrysler. A forensics doctor at the county morgue thought that the men looked Korean." Summer finished eating the rice and set down the bowl and chopsticks. "Korea?" she asked, her brow furrowing. "Korea." Ed Coyle's eyes had long since grown weary of scanning the flat, gray sea for something out of the ordinary. He nearly didn't trust his eyes when something finally tugged at the corner of his vision. Focusing towards the horizon, he just barely made out a small light in the sky, dragging a wispy white tail. It was exactly what the co-pilot of the Lockheed HC-130 Hercules search and rescue plane had been hoping to see. "Charlie, I've got a flare at 2 o'clock," Coyle said into his microphoned headset with the smooth voice of an ESPN sportscaster. Instinctively, he pointed a gloved hand at a spot on the windshield where he'd seen the white burst. "I got her," Major Charles White replied with a slight drawl while peering out the cockpit. A lanky Texan with a cucumber-cool demeanor, the HC-130's pilot gently banked the aircraft towards the fading smoke stream and slightly reduced airspeed. 6 hours after departing Kadena Air Base in Okinawa, the search and rescue pilots had started wondering whether their mission was a wild goose chase. Now they crept to the edge of their seats, wondering what they would find in the waters beneath them. A grouping of white dots slowly appeared on the distant horizon, gradually growing larger as the aircraft approached. "Looks like we've got us some lifeboats," White stated as the specks grew into distinguishable shapes. 7 of them," Coyle confirmed, counting the small boats stretched in a line. Morgan had rounded up all the lifeboats and lashed them together, bow to stern, in order to keep the survivors together. As the Hercules flew in low over them, the crew of the Sea Rover waved wildly in response and let out a collective cheer. "Roughly 60 heads," Coyle estimated as White brought the plane around in a slow circle. "They look to be in pretty good shape. Let's hold the PJs, drop an emergency medical pack, and see if we can initiate a sea pickup." The PJs were 3 medically trained pararescue jumpers in the back of the plane, ready to parachute out of the HC-130 at a moment's notice. Since the crew of the Sea Rover appeared in no imminent danger, White opted to withhold their deployment for the time being. A loadman at the back of the Hercules instead lowered a big hydraulic door beneath the tail and, at Coyle's command, shoved out several emergency medical and ration packs, which drifted down to the sea in small parachutes. An airborne communications specialist had meanwhile issued a distress call over the marine frequency. Within seconds, several nearby ships answered the call, the closest being a container ship bound for Hong Kong from Osaka. White and Coyle continued to circle the lifeboats for another 2 hours until the container ship arrived on the scene and began taking aboard survivors off the first lifeboat. Satisfied they were now safe, the rescue plane took a final low pass over the castaways, White waggling the wingtips as he passed. Though the pilots could not hear it, the tired and haggard survivors let out a robust cheer of thanks that echoed across the water. "Lucky devils," Coyle commented with satisfaction. White nodded in silent agreement, then banked the Hercules southeast towards its home base on Okinawa. The large freighter had let go a welcoming blast of its Kallenberg air horn as it glided towards the lifeboats. A whaleboat was lowered to guide the shipwreck victims around to a lowered stairwell near the stern, where most of the Sea Rover's crew climbed up to the high deck. Morgan and a few other injured crewmen were transferred to the whaleboat and hoisted up to the container ship's main deck. After a brief welcome and inquiry by the ship's Malaysian captain, Morgan was rushed down to the medical bay for treatment of his wounds. Ryan caught up with him after the ship's doctor had tended to the Numa captain's leg and confined him to a bunk next to the crewman with the broken leg. "How's the prognosis, sir?" "The knee's a mess, but I'll live." "They do amazing things with artificial joints these days," Ryan encouraged. "Apparently I'll be finding that out in an intimate way." "Beats a peg leg, I guess." "What's the state of the crew?" "In good spirits now." With the exception of Dirk and Summer, the Sea Rover's crew was all aboard and accounted for. "I borrowed Captain Malacca's satellite phone and called Washington. I was able to speak directly with Rudy Gunn and informed him of our situation after briefing him on the loss of the ship. I let him know that our recovered cargo, along with Dirk, Summer, and the submersible, are believed aboard the Japanese cable ship. He asked me to express his thanks to you for saving the crew and promised that the highest levels of the government will be activated to apprehend those responsible." Morgan stared blankly at a white wall, his mind tumbling over the events of the past few hours. Who were these pirates that had attacked and sunk his ship? What was their intent with the biological weapons? And what had become of Dirk and Summer? Not generating any answers, he simply shook his head slowly. "I just hope it won't be too late."